This is Audible.
A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away. Penguin Random House Audio presents Star Wars, Tarkin, by James Luceno. Read for you by Ewan Morton. Five standard years have passed since Darth Sidious proclaimed himself Galactic Emperor. The brutal Clone Wars are a memory, and the Emperor's apprentice, Darth Vader, has succeeded in hunting down most of the Jedi who survived dreaded Order 66. On Coruscant, a servile Senate applauds the Emperor's every decree, and the populations of the core worlds bask in a sense of renewed prosperity. In the Outer Rim, meanwhile, the myriad species of former separatist worlds find themselves no better off than they were before the Civil War. Stripped of weaponry and resources, they have been left to fend for themselves in an empire that has largely turned its back on them. Where resentment has boiled over into acts of sedition, the Empire has been quick to mete out punishment. But as confident as he is in his own and Vader's dark side powers, the Emperor understands that only a supreme military, overseen by a commander with the will to be as merciless as he is, can secure an empire that will endure for 1,000 generations. Chapter 1. The Measure of a Man. A saying emerged during the early years of the Empire. Better to be spaced than based on Belderone. Some commentators traced the origin to the last of the original Kamino-grown soldiers who had served alongside the Jedi in the Clone Wars. Others to the first crop of cadets graduated from the Imperial Academies. Besides expressing disdain for assignments on worlds located far from the core, the adage implied that star system assignment was a designator of worth. The closer to Coruscant one was posted, the greater one's importance to the Imperial cause. Though on Coruscant itself, most effectives preferred to be deployed far from the palace, rather than anywhere within range of the Emperor's withering gaze. For those in the know, then, it seemed inexplicable that Wilhuff Tarkin should be assigned to a desolate moon in a nameless system in a remote region of the Outer Rim. The closest planets of any note were the desert world Tatooine and equally inhospitable Geonosis, on whose irradiated surface the Clone Wars had begun and which had since become a denied outlier to all but an inner circle of Imperial scientists and engineers. What could the former Admiral and Adjutant General have done to merit an assignment most would have regarded as a banishment? What insubordination or dereliction of duty had prompted the Emperor to exile one he himself had promoted to the rank of Moff at the end of the war? Rumors flew fast and furious among Tarkin's peers in all branches of the military. Tarkin had failed to carry out an important mission in the Western Reaches. He had quarreled with the Emperor or his chief henchman, Darth Vader. Or his reach had simply exceeded his grasp, and he was paying the price for naked ambition. For those who knew Tarkin personally, however, or had even a passing familiarity with his upbringing and long record of service, the reason for the assignment was obvious. Tarkin was engaged in a clandestine Imperial enterprise. In the memoir that was published years after his incendiary death, Tarkin wrote, "After much reflection, I came to realize that the years I spent at Sentinel Base were as formative as my years of schooling on Iriadu's Carrion Plateau, or as significant as any of the battles in which I had participated or commanded. For I was safeguarding the creation of an armament that would one day shape and guarantee the future of the Empire, both as impregnable fortress and as symbol of the Emperor's inviolable rule. The deep space mobile battle station was an achievement on the order of any fashioned by the ancestral species that had unlocked the secret of hyperspace and opened the galaxy to exploration. My only regret was in not employing a firmer hand in bringing the project to fruition in time to frustrate the actions of those determined to thwart the Emperor's noble designs. Fear of the station, fear of imperial might, would have provided the necessary deterrent. Not once in his personal writings did Tarkin liken his authority to that of the Emperor or of Darth Vader. And yet even so simple a task as overseeing the design of a new uniform was perhaps a means of casting himself in garb as distinctive as the hooded robes of the former or the latter's signature black mask. An analysis of trends in military fashion on Coruscant suggests a more tailored approach, a protocol droid was saying. Tunics continue to be double-breasted with choker collars, but are absent shoulder boards or epaulettes. What's more, trousers are no longer straight-legged, but flared in the hips and thighs, narrowing at the cuffs so as to be easily tucked into tall boots with low heels.
A commendable alteration, Tarkin said.
May I suggest, then, sir, flare-legged trousers, in the standard-issue grey-green fabric, of course, accented by black knee boots with turned-down topside cuffs. The tunic itself should be belted at the waist and fall to mid-thigh.
Tarkin glanced at the silver-bodied humaniform couturier. While I can appreciate devotion to one's sartorial programming, I have no interest in initiating a fashion trend on Coruscant or anywhere else. I simply want a uniform that fits, especially the boots. The stars know my feet have logged more kilometers aboard star destroyers than during surface deployments, even in a facility of this size. The RA-7 droid canted its shiny head to one side in a show of disapproval.
There is a marked difference between a uniform that fits and a uniform that suits the wearer, if you take my meaning, sir. May I also point out that as a sector governor, you have the freedom to be a bit more, shall we say, daring. If not in color, then in the hand of the cloth, the length of the tunic, the cut of the trousers.
Tarkin considered the droid's remarks in silence. Years of shipboard and downside duties had not been kind to the few dress and garrison uniforms he retained, and no one on Sentinel Base would dare criticize any liberties he might take. All right, he said finally. Display what you have in mind. Dressed in an olive-drab body glove that encased him from neck to ankles and concealed the scars left by wounds from blaster fire, falls, and the claws of predators, Tarkin was standing on a low circular platform opposite a garment fabricator whose several laser readers were plying his body with red beams, taking and recording his measurements to within a fraction of a millimeter. With his legs and arms spread, he might have been a statue mounted on a plinth, or a target galvanized in the sights of a dozen snipers. Adjacent to the fabricator sat a hollow table that projected above its surface a life-sized hologram of him, clothed in a uniform whose designs changed in accordance with the silent commands of the droid, and which could be rotated on request or ordered to adopt alternate postures. The rest of Tarkin's modest quarters were given over to a bunk, a dresser, fitness apparatus, and a sleek desk situated between cushioned swivel chairs and two more basic models. A man of black and white tastes, he favored clean lines, precise architecture, and an absence of clutter. A large viewport looked out across an illuminated square of landing field to a massive shield generator and beyond to the U-shaped range of lifeless hills that cradled Sentinel Base. On the landing field were two wind-blasted shuttles, along with Tarkin's personal starship, the Carrion Spike. Sentinel's host moon enjoyed close to standard gravity, but it was a cold, forlorn place. Wrapped in a veil of toxic atmosphere, the secluded satellite was battered by frequent storms and as colorless as the pallet that held sway in Tarkin's quarters.
Even now, an ill-omened tempest was swooping down the ridge and beginning to pelt the viewport with stones and grit. Base personnel called it hard rain, if only to lighten the dreariness such storms conjured. The dark sky belonged chiefly to the swirling gas giant that owned the moon. On those long days when the moon emerged into the light of the system's distant yellow sun, the surface glare was too intense for human eyes, and the base's viewports had to be sealed or polarized.
"Your impressions, sir,"
the droid said. Tarkin studied his full-color hollow doppelganger, focusing less on the altered uniform than on the man it contained. At 50, he was lean to the point of gaunt, with strands of wavy gray streaking what had been auburn hair. The same genetics that had bequeathed him blue eyes and a fast metabolism had also granted him sunken cheeks that imparted a mask-like quality to his face. His narrow nose was made to appear even longer than it was, courtesy of a widow's peak that had grown more pronounced since the end of the war. As well, deep creases now bracketed his wide, thin-lipped mouth. Many described his face as severe, though he judged it pensive, or perhaps penetrating. As for his voice, he was amused when people attributed his arrogant tone to an outer rim upbringing and accent. He turned his clean-shaven face to both sides and lifted his chin. He folded his arms across his chest, then stood with his hands clasped behind his back, and finally posed akimbo, with his fists planted on his hips. Drawing himself up to his full height, which was just above human average, he adopted a serious expression, cradling his chin in his right hand. There were few beings to whom he needed to offer salute, though there was one to whom he was obliged to bow, and so he did, straight-backed, but not so low as to appear sycophantic. "Eliminate the top-line collars on the boots and lower the heels," he told the droid.
"Of course, sir. Standard geranium shank and toes for the boots?"
Tarkin nodded. Stepping down from the platform, out from inside the cage of laser tracers, he began to walk circles around the hologram, appraising it from all sides. During the war, the belted tunic, when closed, had extended across the chest on one side and across the midsection on the other. Now the line was vertical, which appealed to Tarkin's taste for symmetry. Just below each shoulder were narrow pockets designed to accommodate short cylinders that contained coded information about the wearer. A rank insignia plaque, made up of two rows of small colored squares, was affixed to the tunic's left breast. Medals and battle ribbons had no place on the uniform, nor in the imperial military. The Emperor was scornful of commendations for sand or pluck. Where another leader might wear garments of the finest synth silk, the Emperor favored robes of black patterned zayd cloth, often concealing his face within the cowl, furtive, exacting, ascetic.
"More to your liking?"
the droid asked, when its cordwainer program had tasked the holoprojector to incorporate changes to the boots. "Better," Tarkin said, "except perhaps for the belt. Send her an officer's disc on the buckle and a matching one on the command cap." He was about to elaborate when a childhood recollection took him down a different path, and he snorted in self-amusement. He must have been all of 11 at the time, dressed in a multi-pocketed vest he thought the perfect apparel for what he had assumed was going to be a jaunt on the Carrion Plateau. On seeing the vest, his grand-uncle Jova had smiled broadly, then issued a laugh that was at once avuncular and menacing. "It'll look even better with blood on it," Jova had said.
"Do you find something humorous in the design, sir?"
the droid asked, in what amounted to distress. Tarkin shook his head. "Nothing humorous, to be sure." The foolishness of the fitting wasn't lost on him. He understood that he was simply trying to distract himself from having to fret over delays that were impeding progress on the battle station. Shipments from research sites had been postponed. Asteroid mining at Geonosis was proving unfeasible. Construction phase deadlines had not been met by the engineers and scientists who were supervising the project. A convoy transporting vital components was due to arrive.
In the ensuing silence, the storm began to beat a mad tattoo on the window. Doubtless, Sentinel Base was one of the Empire's most important outposts. Still, Tarkin had to wonder what his paternal granduncle, who had once told him that personal glory was the only quest worth pursuing, would make of the fact that his most successful apprentice was in danger of becoming a mere administrator. His gaze had returned to the hologram when he heard urgent footsteps in the corridor outside the room. On receiving permission to enter, Tarkin's blonde-haired, clear-eyed adjutant hastened through the door, offering a crisp salute. "A priority dispatch from Rampart Station, sir." A look of sharp attentiveness erased Tarkin's frown. Core word from Sentinel in the direction of the Planet Pi, Rampart was a marshalling depot for supply ships bound for Geonosis, where the deep space weapon was under construction. "I won't tolerate further delays," he started to say. "Understood, sir," the adjutant said. "But this doesn't concern supplies. Rampart reports that it is under attack." Chapter 2. Blows Against the Empire. The door to Tarkin's quarters whooshed open, disappearing into the partition, and out he marched, dressed in worn trousers and ill-fitting boots, with a lightweight grey-green duster draped over his shoulders. As the adjutant hurried to keep pace with the taller man's determined steps, the strident voice of the protocol droid slithered through the opening before the door resealed itself.
"But, sir, the fitting!"
Originally a cramped garrison base deployed from a Victory-class Star Destroyer, Sentinel now sprawled in all directions as a result of prefabricated modules that had since been delivered or assembled on site. The heart of the facility was a warren of corridors linking one module to the next, their ceilings lost behind banks of harsh illuminators, forced air ducts, fire suppression pipes, and bundled strands of snaking wires. Everything had an improvised look. But as this was Moff Wilhuff Tarkin's domain, the radiantly heated walkways and walls were spotless, and the pipes and feeds were meticulously organized and labeled with alphanumerics. Overworked scrubbers purged staleness and the smell of ozone from the recycled air. The corridors were crowded not only with specialists and junior officers, but also with droids of all sizes and shapes, twittering, beeping, and chirping to one another as their optical sensors assessed the speed and momentum of Tarkin's forward march and propelling themselves out of harm's way at the last possible instant on treads, casters, repulsors, and ungainly metal legs. Between the blare of distant alarms and the warble of announcements ordering personnel to muster stations, it was difficult enough to hear oneself think, and yet Tarkin was receiving updates through an ear bead, as well as communicating continually with Sentinel's command center through a speck of a microphone adhered to his voice box. He wedged the audio bead deeper into his ear as he strode through a domed module whose skylight wells revealed that the storm had struck with full force and was shaking Sentinel for all it was worth. Exiting the dome and moving against a tide of staff and droids, he right-angled through two short stretches of corridor, doors flying open at his approach, and additional personnel joining him at each juncture. Senior officers, Navy troopers, communications technicians, some of them young and shorn, most of them in uniform, and all of them human. So that by the time he reached the command center, the duster billowing behind him like a cape, it was as if he were leading a parade. At Tarkin's request, the rectangular space was modeled after the sunken data pits found aboard Imperial-class Star Destroyers. Filing in behind him, the staffers he had gathered along the way rushed to their duty stations, even while others already present were leaping to their feet to deliver salutes. Tarkin waved them back into their swivel chairs and positioned himself on a landing at the center of the room with a clear view of the holo-images, sensor displays, and authenticators. Off to one side of him, Base Commander Kessel, dark-haired and sturdy, was leaning across the primary holo-projector table, above which twitched a grainy image of antique starfighters executing strafing runs across Rampart's gleaming surface, while the marshalling station's batteries responded with green pulses of laser energy. In a separate holovid, even more corrupted than the first, insect-winged Geonosian laborers could be seen scrambling for cover in one of the station's starfighter hangars.
A distorted voice was crackling through the command center's wall-mounted speaker array.
Our shields are already down to 40%, Sentinel. Jamming our transmission. Lost communication with the Brental. Request immediate... Sentinel. Again, request immediate reinforcement.
A skeptical frown formed on Tarkin's face. A sneak attack? Impossible. Rampart reports that the attack ship transmitted a valid holonet code on entering the system. Cassell said, Rampart, can you eavesdrop on the comm chatter of those starfighters?
Negative, Sentinel.
The reply came a long moment later.
They're jamming our signals, Net.
Peering over his shoulder at Tarkin, Cassell made as if to cede his position, but Tarkin motioned for him to stay where he was. Can the image be stabilized? He asked the specialist at the holoprojector controls.
Sorry, sir,
the specialist said. Increasing the gain only makes matters worse. The transmission appears to be corrupted at the far end. I haven't been able to establish if Rampart initiated countermeasures. Tarkin glanced around the room.
And on our end? The holonet relay station is best possible,
the specialist at the comm board said. It is raining, sir. A different spec added, eliciting a chorus of good-natured laughter from others seated nearby. Even Tarkin grinned, though fleetingly.
Who are we speaking with?
He asked Cassell.
A Lieutenant Thawne, the commander said. He's been on station for only 3 months, but he's following protocol and transmitting on priority encryption.
Tarkin clasped his hands behind his back beneath the duster and glanced at the specialist seated at the authenticator.
Does the effectives roster contain an image of our Lieutenant Thawne?
On screen, sir,
the staffer said, flicking a joystick and indicating one of the displays. Tarkin shifted his gaze. A sandy-haired human with protruding ears, Thawne was as untried as he sounded. Fresh from one of the academies, Tarkin thought. He stepped down from the platform and moved to the hollow projector table to study the strafing starfighters more closely. Bars of corruption elevated through the stuttering horovid. Rampart's shields were nullifying most of the aggressor's energy beams, but all too frequently a disabling run would succeed, and white-hot explosions would erupt in one of the depot's deep-space docks.
Those are Tikias and headhunters, Tarkin said in surprise.
Modified, Cassell said. Basic hyperdrives and upgraded weaponry.
Tarkin squinted at the hollow.
The fuselages bear markings.
He turned in the direction of the speck closest to the authenticator station.
Run the markings through the database. Let's see if we can't determine whom we're dealing with.
Tarkin turned back to Cassell.
Did they arrive on their own, or launch from the attack ship?
Delivered, the commander said.
Without turning around, Tarkin said,
Has this Thawne provided holovid or coordinates for the vessel that brought the starfighters?
Holovid, sir, someone said. But we only got a quick look at it.
Replay the transmission, Tarkin said.
A separate holotable projected a blurry, blue-tinted image of a fan-tailed capital ship with a spherical control module located amidships. The down-sloping curved bow and smooth hull gave it the look of a deep-sea behemoth. Tarkin circled the table, appraising the hologram.
What is this thing?
Begged and borrowed, sir, someone reported. Separatist-era engineering more than anything else.
The central sphere resembles one of the old Trade Federation droid control computers, and the entire forward portion might have come from a Commerce Guild destroyer. Front-facing sensor array tower. IFF's highlighting modules consistent with CIS Providence, Recusant, and Munificent-class warships.
Pirates,
Cassell ventured.
Privateers?
Have they issued any demands? Tarkin asked.
Nothing yet.
Cassell waited a beat.
Insurgents?
No data on the starfighter fuselage markings, sir, someone said.
Tarkin touched his jaw but said nothing. As he continued to circle the hologram, a flare of wavy corruption in the lower left portion captured his attention.
What was that?
He said, standing tall.
At the lower... There it is again. He counted quietly to himself. At the count of 10, he fixed his gaze on the same area of the hologram. And again! He swung to the specialist. Replay the recording at half speed. Tarkin kept his eyes on the lower left quadrant as the holovid restarted and began a new count. Now, he said, in advance of every instance of corruption. Now! Chairs throughout the room swiveled.
Encryption noise, someone suggested.
Ionization effect, another said.
Tarkin held up a hand to silence the speculations.
This isn't a guessing game, ladies and gentlemen.
Interval corruption of some sort, Cassell said.
Of some sort indeed.
Tarkin watched silently as the pre-recorded holovid recycled for a third time. Then he moved to the communications station.
Instruct Lieutenant Thorn to show himself, he said to the seated spec.
Sir?
Tell him to train a cam on himself.
The spec relayed the command, and Thorn's voice issued from the speakers.
Sentinel, I've never been asked to do that, but if that's what it's going to take to effect a rescue, then I'm happy to comply.
Everyone in the room turned to the holofeed, and moments later, a 3D image of Thorn took shape above the table.
Recognition is well within acceptable margin, sir,
the spec said. Tarkin nodded and leaned toward one of the microphones.
Stand by, Rampart. Reinforcements are forthcoming.
He continued to study the live holovid and had begun yet another count when the transmission abruptly de-resolved, just short of the moment it might have displayed further evidence of corruption.
What happened?
Cassell asked.
Working on it, sir,
a spec said. Repressing a knowing smile, Tarkin glanced over his right shoulder.
Have we tried to open a clear channel to Rampart? We've been trying, sir,
the comms specialist said,
but we haven't been able to penetrate the jamming.
Tarkin moved to the communications station.
What resources do we have upside? Parking lot is nearly empty, sir.
The comms specialist riveted her eyes on the board.
We have the Salich, the Fremont, and the Electrum.
Tarkin considered his options.
Sentinel's Imperial-class Star Destroyer, the Core Envoy, and most of the flotilla's other capital ships were escorting supply convoys to Geonosis.
That left him with a frigate and a tug, both vacant just then, literally parked in stationary orbits, and the obvious choice, the Electrum, a Venator-class Star Destroyer, on loan from a deep dock at Ryloth.
Contact Captain Burke, he said at last. Already on the comm, sir,
the specialist said. A quarter-scale image of the captain rose from the comm station's holoprojector. Burke was tall and gangly, with a clipped brown beard lining his strong jaw.
Governor Tarkin, he said, saluting.
Are you up to speed on what is occurring at Rampart Station, Captain Burke?
We are, sir. The Electrum is prepared to jump to Rampart on your command.
Tarkin nodded.
Keep those hyperspace coordinates at the ready, Captain. But right now, I want you to execute a micro-jump to the rimward edge of this system. Do you understand?
Burke frowned in confusion, but he said,
Understood, Governor.
You're to hold there and await further orders.
In plain sight, sir, or obscure?
I suspect that won't matter one way or another, Captain. But all the better if you can find something to hide behind.
Excuse me for asking, sir, but are we expecting trouble?
Always, Captain, Tarkin said, without levity.
The hologram disappeared, and the command center fell eerily silent, save for the sounds of the sensors and scanners and the tech's update that the Electrum was away. The silence deepened, until a pressing and prolonged warning tone from the threat assessment station made everyone start. The specialist at the station thrust his head forward.
Sir, sensors are registering anomalous readings and Kronau radiation in the red zone. Wake rotation!
Another spec cut in.
We've got a mark in from hyperspace, sir, and it's a big one. 920 meters long, gunnage of 12 turbo laser cannons, 10 point defense ion cannons, 6 proton torpedo launchers.
reverting on the near side of the planet. Range is 200,000 clicks and closing. He blew out his breath.
Good thing you dispatched the Electrum, sir, or it'd be in pieces by now.
A specialist seated at an adjacent duty station weighed in. Firing solution programs are being sent to downside defenses. IFF is profiling it as the same carrier that attacked Rampart. The spec glanced at Tarkin. Could it have jumped, sir?
If the ship was even there,
Tarkin said, mostly to himself.
Sir?
Tarkin shrugged out of the duster, letting it fall to the floor, and stepped down to the holoprojector.
Let's have a look at it.
If the ship in the orbital feed holovid was not the same one that had ostensibly attacked Rampart, it had to be her twin.
Sir, we have got multiple marks launching from the carrier.
The spec interrupted himself to make certain he was interpreting the readings correctly.
Sir, they're droid fighters. Tri-fighters, vultures, the whole set menagerie.
Interesting,
Tarkin said in a calm voice. One hand to his chin, he continued to assess the hologram.
Commander Cassell, sound general quarters and boost power to the base shields. Signals, initiate countermeasures.
Sir, is this an unannounced readiness test?
Someone asked.
More like a bunch of separatists who didn't get the message they lost the war, another said.
Perhaps that was the explanation, Tarkin thought. Imperial forces had destroyed or appropriated most of the capital ships produced for and by the Confederacy of Independent Systems. Droid fighters hadn't been seen in years. But it was even longer since Tarkin had witnessed holonet subterfuge of the caliber someone had aimed at Sentinel Base. He swung away from the table.
Scan the carrier for life forms, on the off chance we are dealing with a sentient adversary, rather than a droid control computer.
He eyed the comms specialist.
Any separate channel response from Rampart?
She shook her head.
Still no word, sir.
Carrier shows 30 life forms, sir,
someone at the far end of the room said.
It's astrogating by command, not on full auto.
From the threat station came another voice.
Sir, droid fighters are nearing the edge of the envelope.
And a thin envelope it was, Tarkin thought.
Alert our artillery crews to ignore the firing solution programs and to fire at will.
He pivoted to the holotable. A glance revealed Sentinel Base to be in the same situation Rampart appeared to have been in only moments earlier, except that the enemy ships and the holofeed were genuine.
Contact Captain Burke and tell him to come home.
Tri-fighters are breaking formation and commencing attack runs.
The sounds of distant explosions and the thundering replies of ground-based artillery infiltrated the command center. The room shook. Motes of dust drifted down from the overhead pipes and cables. The illumination flickered. Tarkin monitored the ground feed holovids. The droid fighters were highly maneuverable, but no match for Sentinel's powerful guns. The moon's storm-racked sky grew backlit with strobing flashes and globular detonations, as one after another of the ridge-backed tri-fighters and reconfigurable vultures was vaporized. A few managed to make it to the outer edge of the base's hemispherical defensive shield, only to be annihilated there and hit the coarse ground in flames.
They're beginning to turn tail, a tech said. Laser cannons are chasing them back up the well.
And the capital ship? Tarkin said.
The carrier is steering clear and accelerating. Range is now 300,000 clicks and expanding. All weapons are mute.
Sir, the Electrum has reverted to real space.
Tarkin grinned faintly.
Inform Captain Burke that his TIE pilots are going to enjoy a target-rich environment.
Captain Burke on the comm.
Tarkin moved to the comm station, where Burke's hollow presence hovered above the projector.
I trust that this is the trouble you were expecting, Governor.
Actually, Captain, most of this is quite unexpected. Therefore, I hope you'll do your best to incapacitate the carrier, rather than destroy it. No doubt we can glean something by interrogating the crew.
I'll be as gentle with it as I can, Governor.
Tarkin glanced at the holotable in time to see squadrons of newly minted ball cockpit TIE fighters launch from the dorsal bay of the arrowhead-shaped Star Destroyer.
Sir, I have Rampart Station Commander Jai on the comm. Voice only.
Tarkin gestured for Jai to be put through.
Governor Tarkin, to what do I owe the honor?
Jai said. Tarkin positioned himself close to one of the command center's audio pickups. How is everything at your depot, Lin?
Better now,
Jai said.
Our holonet relay was down for a short period, but it's back online. I've sent a tech team to determine what went wrong. You have my word, Governor. The glitch won't affect the supply shipment schedule.
I doubt that your technicians will discover any evidence of malfunction, Tarkin said. Instead of speaking to it, Jai said,
And on your moon, Governor?
As a matter of fact, we find ourselves under attack.
What?
Jai asked in patent surprise. I'll explain in due course, Lin. Just now we have our hands full. His back turned to the holo projector table, Tarkin missed the event that drew loud groans from many of the staffers. When he turned, the warship was gone.
Jumped to light speed before the Electrum could get off a disabling shot,
Cassell said. Disappointment pulled down the corners of Tarkin's mouth. With the capital ship gone, the remaining droid fighters could be seen spinning out of control. Even easier prey for the vertical-winged TIE fighters. A scattering of spherical explosions flared at the edge of space. Gather debris of any value, Tarkin said to Burke, and have it transported down the well for analysis. Snare a few of the intact droids as well, but take care. While they appear to be lifeless, they may be rigged to self-destruct. Burke acknowledged the command, and the holo vanished. Tarkin looked at Cassell. Secure from battle stations and sound the all clear. I want a forensic team assembled to examine the droids. I doubt we'll learn much, but we may be able to ascertain the carrier's point of origin. He grew pensive for a moment, then added, Prepare an after-action report for Coruscant and transmit it to my quarters so I can append my notes.
Will do,
Cassell said. A specialist handed Tarkin his duster, and he had started for the door when a voice rang out behind him.
Sir, a question, if you will.
Tarkin stopped and turned around.
Ask it. How did you know, sir?
How did I know what, Corporal? The young, brown-haired specialist gnawed at her lower lip before continuing.
That the holo transmission from Rampart Station was counterfeit, sir.
Tarkin looked her up and down.
Perhaps you'd care to proffer an explanation of your own. In the replay, the bar of interval noise you noticed, somehow that told you that someone had managed to introduce a false real-time feed into the local holonet relay.
Tarkin smiled faintly. Train yourself to recognize it. All of you. Deception may be the least of what our unknown adversaries have in store.
Chapter 3 Cold Case. In Sentinel's maintenance hangar, Tarkin paced the length of a high blast-proof partition. The storm had blown through and the base had resumed normal operations, but many of the soldiers and specialists were still passing the fact that Sentinel had come under attack. For the youngest among them, recruits or volunteers, it was the first action they had ever seen. On the far side of a series of massive transparisteel panels set into the partition, several hazmat-suited forensic technicians were examining wreckage from the battle and running tests on three droid starfighters, grasped in cradles suspended from tall gantries. Elsewhere in the hangar, load lifters and other droids were sorting through piles of debris. The tang of lubricants and flame-scorched metals hung in the air, and the noise level created by the labor droids was grating. As Tarkin had warned, many of the vulture droids had transformed into bombs on losing contact with the warship's central control computer. Regardless, Captain Burke's salvage teams had managed to recover a droid whose auto-destruct mechanism had been damaged during combat. Hung in walking configuration, with its blaster cannon lateral wings split, the 3.5-meter-long vulture looked less like its namesake scavenger than it did a long-legged alloy quadruped with an equine head. With the central nacelle open and the computer brain exposed and studded with instruments,
The droid might have been undergoing torture rather than autopsy. The other two dangling captives, three armed fighters that mirrored the appearance of the species that had designed them, were similarly exposed and quilled with probes. Tarkin had lost count of how many back-and-forth meanders he had completed, and was standing opposite the vulture droid when a decontamination lock in the partition opened and a tech emerged, removing the hood of his anti-rad suit and wiping sweat from his face and balding pate with a bare hand. Tarkin spun around to meet him halfway. "What have you learned?"
"Not as much as we'd hoped to, sir," the tech said. "Analysis of data received by the command center's friend or foe indicator confirms that the capital ship is a downsized version of a separatist Providence-class cruiser carrier, modified with modules taken from CIS frigates and destroyers. Ships of the sort made a name for themselves during the war by jamming signals and destroying holonet relays. Parts of the ship's sensor array tower, which the SEPs usually mounted aft rather than forward, appear to have come from the cruiser Lucid Voice, which saw action at Quell, Ryloth, and in a couple of other contested systems." Tarkin frowned. "How did the appropriation teams manage to miss confiscating that ship?"
"They didn't, sir. Records show that the Lucid Voice was dismantled at the Bilbringi shipyards 4 years ago."
Tarkin considered that.
"In other words, some components of that vessel went missing."
"Lost, stolen, sold, it's impossible to say. Other sections of the warship appear to have come from the Invincible."
Tarkin didn't bother to mask his surprise. "That was Separatist Admiral Trench's ship, destroyed during the Battle of Christophsis."
"Partially destroyed, in any case.
The ship was modular in design, and the modules that survived must have been worth salvaging and putting on the open market. Parts dealers in the Outer Rim are desperate for supplies, so the modules may have ended up in the Tion cluster or the like." The tech removed his other elbow-length glove and wiped his face again. "The Idelian scanner isolated 30 lifeforms, a crew of humans and near-humans, which is in keeping with the practice of placing sentients in command of most Providence-class ships. But for a ship of that size and armament, 30 sentients is virtually your definition of a skeleton crew. Sometimes these SEPs substituted OOM pilot battle droids, and I'm guessing our skittish warship had some of those as well, because whoever cobbled the thing together retrofitted it with a rudimentary droid control computer, possibly a redundant comp of the sort you used to find on first-generation Trade Federation Lucre Hulks."
"Whoever, as you say."
"Lucid Voice was built by the Quarren Free Dak Volunteers Engineering Corps, much to the displeasure of the Mon Cals, who shared their planet with the Quarren. We're checking to see if QFD, or their erstwhile partners, Pamet Dox, might have supervised the reassembly.
Trade Fed and Separatist technology has been showing up lately in the corporate sector, so we're also looking into the possibility that the ship was built there. The headhunter starfighter seen in the holovid could have come from anywhere. TKRs are produced in the Senex, but it's not uncommon to encounter them in this sector of the rim."
Tarkin nodded and motioned toward the hangar. "The droids?" The specialist turned to face the viewports. "Relatively few modifications to the Vulture. Same fuel slug propulsion, same weapons system. Alphanumeric identification indicates that this one belonged to a Confederacy battle group known as the Grievous Legion."
"And also managed to find its way onto the black market."
"So it appears, sir."
Tarkin moved farther down the partition. "And the tri-fighters?"
"Unremarkable. But we've no evidence regarding their origin. Not yet, anyway."
Tarkin forced an exhalation through his nose.
"Were you able to retrieve data regarding the warship's point of origin?"
The specialist shook his head. "Negative, sir. The memory modules of the droids don't log jump information."
"All right.
Tarkin said after a moment. Continue with the analysis. I want every weld and rivet investigated.
We're on top of it, sir.
The tech pulled the hood back over his head, slipped his hands into the long gloves, and disappeared through the lock.
Tarkin watched him enter the hangar, then resumed pacing, replaying the attack in his mind. Harassment of Imperial installations by pirates and malcontents was nothing new, but in almost all cases the assaults had been hit-and-run sorties, and none had taken place so close to heavily defended Geonosis. The counterfeit real-time holotransmission had been designed to draw ships from Sentinel to Rampart Station in the hope of leaving the former vulnerable. But the attack was clearly calculated to be suicidal from its inception. Even if he had dispatched the Electrum to the marshalling station, even if he had been taken in by the distress call and dispatched half his flotilla, the energy shields and laser cannons that protected Sentinel would have been sufficient to ward off any strikes, let alone from droids. The warship seen in the holovid the attackers had transmitted through the local holonet relay had shown up at Sentinel, but where were the modified starfighters, which had to have been flown by living pilots? Despite being crewed by sentients, the mysterious cruiser hadn't discharged any of its point defense or ranged weapons. If destruction of the base was the goal, why hadn't whoever was behind the attack used the ship as a bomb by reverting from hyperspace in closer proximity to the moon? Planetary bodies larger than Sentinel had been shaken to their core by such events. Equally worrisome was the question of how the counterfeiters had known about Lieutenant Farn, whose recent posting to Rampart should have been top secret. The creators of the false holovid had been able to improvise by transmitting a real-time hologram of the young officer in response to Tarkin's order that he show himself. Was Farn involved in the conspiracy? Or had the attackers merely doctored existing footage of him? Lifted, perhaps, from the public holonet or some other source? As troubling as it was to accept that the locations of Sentinel and Rampart bases had been compromised, he still couldn't make sense of the attack itself. What would pirates or privateers stand to gain by launching an ill-fated drone attack? What, for that matter, would political dissidents stand to gain? Was it a case of vengeance? One group fit the bill. The droid Gotra. A lethal band of repurposed battle droids with what some considered legitimate grievances against the Empire for having been abandoned after their service during the Clone Wars. But recent intelligence reports stated that the droid Gotra was still confined to an industrial complex in the bowels of Coruscant, serving as muscle for the Crimora crime syndicate in robberies, protection, kidnapping, illegal salvage, and extortion. It was possible that the Gotra was branching out. It was even possible that the group had learned about Sentinel Base. But it was unlikely that the droids would make use of obsolete weapons to send a message to the Empire. Tarkin shook his head in aggravation. In part, the deep space mobile battle station was meant to put an end to harassments of any sort, whether driven by greed, political dissent, or revenge for acts committed during the Clone Wars or since. Once everyone in the galaxy grasped the weapon's capabilities, once the fear of Imperial reprisal took hold, discontent would cease to be a problem. But just now, and notwithstanding the covert nature of the Geonosis project, the Imperial Security Bureau and Naval Intelligence were continually trying to quash rumors and prevent information leaks. In the 3 years Tarkin had been commanding Sentinel and hundreds of nearby supply and sentry outposts, as well as administering a vast slice of the Outer Rim, no group had been successful in penetrating Geonosis space. The chance that that could change shook him to the core. If establishing the identity of Sentinel's enemies was already proving daunting, getting to the truth of the battle station's origin was nearly impossible. Everyone, from celebrated ship designers to gifted engineers, wanted to take credit for the superweapon. Tarkin himself had discussed the need for such a weapon with the Emperor long before the end of the Clone Wars. But no one outside the Emperor knew the full history of the moonlit-sized project.
Some claimed that it had begun as a separatist weapon designed by Geonosian Archduke Poggle the Lesser's hive colony for Count Dooku and the Confederacy of Independent Systems. But if that was the case, the plans had to have somehow fallen into Republic hands before the Clone Wars ended, because the weapon's spherical shell and laser-focusing dish were already in the works by the time Tarkin first set eyes on it following his promotion to the rank of Moff, escorted to Geonosis in utmost secrecy by the Emperor himself. All the same, he had no compelling reason to solve the enigma of the battle station's beginnings. What bothered him was that, compliant with a strategy that no base commander, Moff, Admiral, or General, should have unrestricted access to information regarding shipments, scheduling, or construction progress, no single person was in charge of the project, unless, of course, the Emperor was considered to be that person. But the Emperor's visits had been few and far between, and it was anyone's guess just how much information was getting past the Imperial Ruling Council the Moffs and others answered to, and actually reaching the Emperor's ear. Certainly he was being briefed, but briefings were no longer enough. The project had reached a point where it had to rely on countless suppliers, and though each was being kept in the dark regarding the final destination of their contributions, millions of beings, perhaps tens of millions of beings galaxy-wide, were now involved with the battle station in one capacity or another. Yes, the project required the on-site presence of a think tank of scientists, weapons specialists, and habitat architects. But what did any of them know about protecting the station from saboteurs? If Tarkin had his way, and at this point it was uncertain he ever would, he would adopt the hegemonic arrangement that was in place on Coruscant and elsewhere, and appoint an overseer to coordinate all construction and defense considerations. A single overseer to whom others would answer, or be damned if they didn't. If whoever was responsible for the dubious attack on Sentinel was simply hoping to get his attention, then that part of the plan had succeeded, for in the end he was left with more questions than answers. His restless pacing subsided as his adjutant hurried into the maintenance hangar's safe area. "A communique from Coruscant, sir." Tarkin assumed that it was military intelligence responding to the after-action report he had filed, and said as much. "No, sir. Higher up the chain of command." Tarkin arched an eyebrow. "How high?" "Nosebleed altitude, sir." Tarkin stiffened slightly. "Then I'll take the transmission in my quarters." Where Tarkin's own uniformed hollow presence had stood 2 days earlier, the hollow table now projected a towering apparition of Vizier Mos Amida, swathed in rich maroon robes, the cyan tint of the hollow field darkening the Shagrian's natural blue pigmentation. From bulging extrusions of flesh on either side of Amida's thick neck dangled tapered horns that matched the pair crowning his hairless cranium.
"We trust all is well at Sentinel Base, Governor."
Tarkin couldn't be certain if or how much Amida knew about the recent attack. On Coruscant, information was closely guarded, if only as a means of maintaining one's cachet, and even the head of the ruling council might not have been made privy to details known to military intelligence and the Admiralty.
"Rest assured, Vizier," Tarkin said.
"No surprises, then?"
"Only the expected ones."
The ambitious amphibian vouchsafed a tight-lipped smile at his end of the duplex holocom. Obstructive and fault-finding during his years as Vice-Chancellor of the Republic Senate, he had become one of the Emperor's most valued advisers, as well as the Empire's most formidable intermediary.
"Governor, your presence is required on Coruscant,"
Amida said, after a moment. Tarkin moved to his desk and sat down, centering himself for the holocam.
"I'll certainly try to make time for a visit, Vizier."
"Permit me, Governor, but that will not suffice. Perhaps I should have said that your presence is urgently required."
Tarkin waved a hand in dismissal. "I'm sorry, Vizier, but that doesn't alter the fact that I have my priorities."
Priorities of what sort?
Tarkin returned Amida's mirthless smile.
There was probably no harm in sharing with Amida information about the expected shipments of materiel from Desolation Station to Geonosis, including vital components for the battle station's complex hyperdrive generator, but he was under no obligation to do so.
I'm afraid my priorities are on a need-to-know basis.
Indeed. Then you are refusing the request.
Tarkin glimpsed something in the thick-skulled Shagrian's pink-rimmed cerulean eyes that gave him pause.
Let's say that I'm reluctant to abandon my post at this time, Vizier. If you wish, I'll provide the Emperor with my reasons personally.
That's not possible, Governor. The Emperor is presently engaged.
Tarkin leaned towards the cam.
So engaged that he can't speak briefly with one of his moths? Amida affected a bored tone.
That is not for me to say, Governor. The Emperor's concerns are on a need-to-know basis.
Tarkin stared into the hologram. What his grand-uncle Jova wouldn't have given to be able to mount a Shagrian head on the wall of his cabin in the Carrion.
Perhaps you're willing to clarify the need for such urgency, he asked.
Amida tilted his massive head to one side.
That's a matter for you to discuss with the Emperor, since it was he who issued the order that you report to Coruscant.
Tarkin concealed a grimace.
You might have said as much at the start, Vizier.
Amida adopted a haughty look.
And deprive us of such verbal sport. Next time, perhaps.
Tarkin remained at his desk after Amida ended the transmission and the hologram vanished. Then he signaled for the protocol droid.
I'm going to need that uniform as soon as possible, he told the RA-7 as it entered.
The droid nodded.
Certainly, sir. I'll instruct the fabricator to begin at once.
Tarkin summoned the uniformed 3D image of himself from the holotable and regarded it, thinking back to Iriadu and recalling Jova's comment once more.
It'll look even better with blood on it. Chapter 4 A Boy's Life.
Cynosure of the Greater Seswana sector of the Outer Rim, Iriadu could trace its history to the earliest era of the Republic. At that time, the galaxy's Dark Age had ended. The Sith had been defeated and driven into hiding, and a true Republic had emerged from the ashes. With a member of House Valorum presiding as Supreme Chancellor, a pan-galactic Senate had been created, and the military had been disbanded. Revitalized, the populations of the core worlds, ravenous for new resources and not above exploiting every opportunity to enhance the quality of their lives, were eager to expand their reach. The planet was transformed from just another outer rim wilderness to a civilized world worth considering for inclusion in the Republic by adventurous pioneers who had been granted permission by Coruscant to procure and settle new territories, either by cutting deals with indigenous populations, or simply by overrunning them, and finally to establish trading colonies capable of furnishing the core with much-needed resources. It was a scenario played out in many remote regions, and in Iriadu's case, the resource happened to be Lomite ore, essential to the production of transparasteel, rich deposits of which had been discovered on worlds throughout the Greater Seswena. Lacking funds to mine, process, and ship the crude, Iriadu settlers had been forced to secure high-interest loans from the intergalactic banking clan. But in an era when hyperspace travel between the Seswena and the core required astrogating by hyperwave beacons, with numerous reversions to real space necessary to ensure safe passage, shipments of ore were frequently delayed or lost due to one catastrophe or another. As debts mounted, Iriadu risked becoming a client world of mune bankers until entrepreneurs from the core world, Korolag, had intervened, rescuing the planet from servitude.
It was likewise through Korolag's influence with the Republic Senate that the fledgling Hylian Way had been routed through Iriadu space and the planet placed on the galactic map. Korolag's motives, however, were not altogether altruistic. The core entrepreneurs forced Iriadu to increase the Lomite supply and had demanded